From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Former CNN host Piers Morgan now observes the American political and social landscape for the British website Mail Online. He shares his thoughts on the presidential primary campaigns.
I think it's wrong to underestimate Trump. I think it's wrong to underestimate his popularity with ordinary working class people in this country. And I think that what Trump does bring to them in their eyes is he's an outsider.
Then, Arthur Viet Thanh Nguyen looks at the legacy of the Vietnam War in Southeast Asia and the U.S. And actor Harry Lennox joins us to talk about his role in the new Batman vs. Superman movie and to explore the ongoing debate over the lack of diversity in Hollywood. It's all today on the Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, after the news. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The presidential primary campaigns are approaching the home stretch, and while Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton seem certain to lock up the Republican and Democratic nominations, their opponents are not going down without a fight. Piers Morgan joins us now to look at the latest news. He's the former host, of course, of Piers Morgan Live on CNN, and now U.S. editor-at-large for the British news outlet Mail Online. For those who don't see this beautiful visage every night on CNN anymore, what have you been doing all these?
I went back home to England. Mm-hmm. I'm actually co-hosting the equivalent of a Today Show there,
right,
called Good Morning Britain.
Yeah.
But I still do a lot of stuff here for DailyMail.com. That's why I'm here now.
Yeah.
And I write about political events here, news, current affairs, that kind of thing. And obviously right now, with all the election phenomenon, no other way of describing it, it's been fascinating.
Yeah. Speaking of fascinating, I was more than fascinated when I saw your piece about why we ought to pay more attention to Donald Trump on foreign policy, and maybe he has a plan to deal with ISIS. I said, Piers wrote this?
Yeah.
So I had to read it. So tell me more about why you feel that way.
Think about Trump, look, full declaration. I've known Donald Trump 10 years. Mm-hmm. I competed in his first season
and won.
The Apprentice and won.
Yes.
So I got to know him very well. I went back on that show every year on his sort of eyes and ears on the boardroom and so on. And I got to see a different side to Trump, to the one that we may be seeing now. Mm-hmm. Far less of a caricature, far less of a cartoon character. Somebody a lot more thoughtful. Mm-hmm. These boardroom sessions would last 3 hours sometimes. Mm-hmm. I never saw a whiff of racism or sexism or any of the things which people now level at him, with good reason in some cases. So I think he's a complicated character, Trump. And he gave an interview to me, actually, for my show in England, in which he talked about, it was the aftermath of the Brussels terror attacks. And he was talking about ISIS and the particular problem we have in Europe with millions of people now moving across Europe from war-torn Syria, Iraq, and so on. And this displacement of people and the fact that we now have huge issues in accommodating genuine asylum seekers and refugees whilst potentially the movement harboring terrorists and how you deal with this. And it just struck me that Trump, compared to Obama, who memorably called ISIS a JV team, which I thought at the time was pretty shocking and has since been proven to be even more shocking because ISIS certainly weren't a JV team. I think that Trump, at least, love him or hate him, I think would be very firm, very decisive, and very tough when it came to tackling an organization like ISIS. And I think that if you look at the issues that have really blown up with Trump in this country, whether it's illegal immigration, whether it's his infamous anti-Muslim ban, which I didn't agree with at all, but I've been down in Florida and Texas recently. There's no doubt that what he's doing is resonating with ordinary Americans, particularly in between New York and L.A.,
working-class people.
Yeah. Working-class people, I think, understand that Trump, to them, sounds tough and decisive. And I looked at what he was saying about ISIS, and I thought, you know, he's making valid points here. And you can trash him, you can say he's a racist, you can accuse his supporters of being racist, but actually you should also listen to some of the things he's saying, because some of it makes sense.
I raise a couple of questions. Number one, every time I watch the news, and I try to avoid local news, but when I do watch it, and some person has done something outrageous, killed a bunch of people or did X, Y, or Z, and all the folk in the neighborhood say, well, not him. We never expect his family, his friends, nobody saw it coming because they knew somebody different. So how do you explain the Donald Trump that you know and the Donald Trump that we see?
I think Trump, at his heart, is a businessman. And I think it's very important to remember that when you see how he's performing on a political stage. Mm-hmm. He's not a politician. Yeah. Trump has gone through life hammering, in terms of his bellicose public utterings, hammering everything to an extreme. Everything. Whether it's television, whether it's whatever it is. Bang, 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 bang. It's always been his way. The only difference now is he's talking about political issues. Mm-hmm. As we saw with the big abortion argument, I don't think he's really thought through some of these positions.
That's obvious.
But of course, at the same time, the reason for that is he's not a proper politician.
Yeah.
And that is one of the reasons people like him. And I look at the way this debate's played out. And look, Trump's now facing a critical moment in this campaign where I think he either reins back and he takes more interest and investment in actual policy, or he may not get the nomination as he probably expected to. Mm-hmm. But I think it's wrong to underestimate Trump. I think it's wrong to underestimate his popularity with ordinary working class people in this country. And I think that what Trump does bring to them in their eyes is he's an outsider.
Yeah.
He's not part of the Washington elite. He is decisive, he's confident, he's bellicose. Trump, meanwhile, is thinking, how do I close the deal?
Yeah.
I'm a businessman. How do I get this done? And I suspect if he won the nomination, you'd see a very different Trump as a candidate against Hillary Clinton. And if he won the presidency, you'd see a very different Trump again.
But how do you explain that these everyday working class people find, to my mind at least, a reckless billionaire to be their savior? Isn't that the most ironic thing that you could ever imagine?
Because I think that they are dispirited and feel let down by the political system. And frankly, having been here for 10 years, I don't blame them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have watched the way Washington has paralyzed itself. You know, I'm a very big supporter of gun control, right? I come from a country where we have very little gun crime, very few guns. And I tried at CNN very hard to try and get a debate going to bring in proper, sensible gun control in this country. It was staggering to me that 20 school children, first graders, could be blown to pieces in their classroom and nothing would be done to stop it again. And I think that that kind of inaction, that kind of paralysis in Washington has allowed Trump, and by the way, on the other side, Bernie Sanders, to come through and to speak and to behave in a way that doesn't sound like a conventional politician.
What do you make of the way the media just flat out missed this Trump moment? And I'm not naive. They clearly played it up. They whipped this thing up for ratings and money. I get that. But now you've got the media doing what I predicted some months ago, flogging themselves publicly from Nick Kristof at the New York Times on down, flogging themselves for how they didn't get this right, that they underestimated. You know,
I think it's fascinating. The media is feeling guilty now.
Yeah.
They're feeling guilty for creating the phenomenon and fueling it, right? But Trump, of course, already was a bit of a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. He was a larger-than-life bellicose billionaire who ran The Apprentice, one of the biggest shows on television, for a decade. I read a column for DailyMail.com the day that he threw his hat in the ring, and everyone else was mocking him. This is going to be over in 2 weeks. Donald Trump, he's a joke, and so on. And I went, you want to be careful. Donald Trump's not a joke. He's a serious-minded guy underneath all the apparent buffoonery. Mm-hmm. He's somebody that will, if he's entering this race, want to win it. He's very competitive, and he's a smart guy. You don't get to be a multi-billionaire tycoon in New York City without being a pretty smart guy. And so I said, do not underestimate him. And I said, and also, I think he will electrify this campaign. Good, bad, and ugly, that's what he'll do. And that's exactly what he's done. I don't agree with many of the things that Trump says. I personally wouldn't vote for him, particularly because of his position on gun control. I couldn't, out of all good conscience, vote for somebody who wouldn't bring in gun control. But I can't vote. I'm a British guy. But I look at it from outside, and I can see how this has happened.
How do they think of Mr. Trump in Britain?
I think it's fair to say he's a very polarizing figure. But I think that in Britain, as in America, as in most parts of the world right now, there are two issues which are really gripping people's attention. Immigration and terrorism, particularly from ISIS. And I think what Trump has latched onto is that these are things that people really care about. And all right, he's taken a sledgehammer to crack a nut, and his policies that he's announced, the wall, the anti-Muslim ban and so on, have been extremely controversial. But I think a lot of people think, well, at least he has a plan. At least he has an idea for how he would counter this. They don't see in, say, Obama here or in Prime Minister David Cameron back in my country, a real fixed idea for how we're going to stop ISIS and how you actually deal with the ongoing issue of illegal immigration.
How do you think historians are going to grade? How will they treat President Obama's era?
You and I talked about this a lot at CNN, and I used to say to you, do you think America is a more racist country because of the ascent of the first black president? And I think we pretty much agreed, well, actually, in a way, it has unfortunately led to America having a bigger outpouring of racism, a lot of anti-Obama stuff out there because he's black. But I also think that Obama has disappointed many people in the African-American community.
And progressive community writ large.
Yes, yeah, I think they feel he's not been there for them. I feel disappointed in Obama because I thought he was a fantastic breath of fresh air. I thought he came with this almost messianic promise that he would really change America. I don't think he has. And I look at things like gun control, where I remember Obama going to Sandy Hook, looking the families in the face, hugging them and saying, I will get action. And then I remember the State of the Union address 2 years ago where he never mentioned the word gun once.
That's right.
And, you know, people have to understand in America what it feels like for people who don't live and work here. In Britain, for example, where we have 32 gun murders a year. To look at a country where you have 35 gun murders every day, and yet nobody apparently wants to do anything about it. People find it staggering. Yeah. And I think that on things like that, I looked at Obama and I thought, you're the guy that's going to try and sort this. And actually, he didn't. Yeah. And there are too many boxes that remain unticked. I think the healthcare was fantastic. I come from a country which has free-for-all healthcare. I completely applaud what he did there. I think things on like gay marriage and everything else are all good ticks in the box. But overall, as a president in this country, disappointing.
Finally, you said you've been spending a lot of time in Florida and Texas of late. For what purpose?
I've been doing a fascinating documentary, actually, called Killer Women.
Killer Women.
With Piers Morgan, yes.
Wow.
And I don't mean Kim Kardashian.
Oh, you're okay.
These are actually murderesses who've done sort of pretty unspeakable things. Right. Female murder is actually quite an unusual thing for women to actually cold-bloodedly, calculatedly, premeditatedly murder people. It's very unusual. And I met a lot of these killers in prison and then went back and sort of investigated thoroughly their stories. And what is fascinating is that in every case, you're not quite sure the motivation which actually leads somebody to premeditatedly murder. So it's been fascinating.
Always enjoyed talking to you on your program.
Thomas,
I'm honored to have you on this
one. It's been a real pleasure.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Viet Thanh Nguyen gained widespread literary fame with his 2015 text, The Sympathizer, a post-Vietnam War novel whose protagonist is a Viet Cong spy who infiltrates the South Vietnamese Army and flees with its remnants to America. Nguyen, a professor of English and American Studies and Ethnicity at USC, continues his examination of the lasting legacy of the conflict in a new nonfiction text called Nothing Ever Dies, Vietnam and the Memory of War. And in it, he explores the different ways the war is remembered in Southeast Asia and the United States. Good to have you back on this program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me start by asking one fiction,
right,
one nonfiction,
right,
both covering the same terrain, which is to say, you know, this war.
Right.
Why two different ways to get at it?
Well, I'm a scholar and a novelist, and I had to do both to try to make sense of this history, which is a very personal history for me, because I was born in Vietnam in 1971, then fled as a refugee in 1975, and my memory begins as a refugee, coming to Pennsylvania and being separated from my parents and sent to live with a white family. And that was a trajectory for, you know, under thinking that this war was so important, it shaped my entire life, and I needed to write both fiction to tell something entertaining and dramatic about that history, and then nonfiction to try to figure out how this war has been remembered by many different countries and why it's still important to us today.
Yeah. Was one experience more difficult, more searing than the other?
I think seeing what happened to my parents was a difficult part, you know, because they survived four decades of war, and they rarely spoke of it. But they exuded the force of that memory just through the way that they lived, how they struggled. And that touched me so deeply, and I could see so many other Vietnamese refugees like them being traumatized by the history of this war. And I understood that most Americans knew nothing of what had happened to the Vietnamese people. They understood what happened to Americans, but for the Vietnamese and other Southeast Asians, a complete blank.
You write in this text powerfully and movingly, I should say, about the way that, I'm paraphrasing here, the way that war is still present, still lingers with your parents even to this day up in Northern California.
Oh, yeah. When Nothing Ever Dies was about to come out, I went home and I talked to my dad and I said, I want to dedicate the book to you guys because of what you've been through and how you've sacrificed for myself and my brother. And I wanted to say, I asked them, how should I write your names? Because their names are said differently where we come from than they are said here. And my dad said, don't put our names in the book. So that's why it just says to my father and mother. And the reason why is because he's still afraid that the history that turned him into a refugee is still alive, that there are people in Vietnam who still care about these kinds of things. So that's part of the reason, you know, Nothing Ever Dies. The war hasn't finished yet for those people who've lived through it, whether they're Vietnamese refugees or American veterans. So many Americans I've talked to still are impacted deeply by this war that happened 50 years ago.
You intimated this earlier. Let me go a little bit deeper now and ask, how is this war viewed differently by those of us in this country as compared to those who are in Vietnam?
58,000 plus Americans died in this war, which is a huge human tragedy. But Americans forget that 3 million Vietnamese people died in this war, and they forget that 3 million other Southeast Asians from Laos and Cambodia died during this war and afterwards. And if you go to Vietnam, it's the reverse. They call it the American War there. And it's important to acknowledge what the Vietnamese people went through. But this book is also about what happened in Laos, what happened in Cambodia, and the fact that the Vietnamese don't want to remember that those countries because both Vietnam and the United States spilled the war over into neighboring countries in Southeast Asia. And the whole world has basically forgotten that that happened.
I wonder what you would say the lessons learned from Vietnam are for us and for Vietnam.
I think the lessons for Americans are dual. There's a good lesson and a bad lesson. And the bad lesson is don't do these kinds of wars. Don't go into some country you're not invited into because terrible things are going to happen. But that lesson has sort of faded over time because everybody from Jimmy Carter to Barack Obama, Democrats to Republicans, have talked about this war now as a noble sacrifice. And so now there's a good lesson to be taken from this war, which is if we do this, we can do it better because of the lessons we learned in the Vietnam War. That's a lesson that the Pentagon has taken, that the U.S. government has taken out of that. And as for the Vietnamese, their lesson is, you know, the North Vietnamese who won this war sacrificed 1 million soldiers and 2 million civilians. Their lesson is, let's make sure that the Vietnamese people remember this as a heroic war and not as a bad war, even though there are a lot of Vietnamese people who actually think of it as a bad war, too.
I understand how, and I've had this experience any number of times, I understand how my Jewish brothers, our Jewish brothers and sisters get offended when people even come close to comparing something contemporary to the Holocaust. And yet from time to time, I can think of Iraq, I think of Afghanistan, where in the news we will say, this is getting dangerously close to another Vietnam. When you hear those kinds of analogies, how does that strike you?
Ambivalently, because I think it actually is important to remember that this happened in this country. But the problem for Vietnamese people is they keep saying, this is a country, not a war. And the rest of the world remembers Vietnam as a war. And that just obliterates just the diversity of the country and how it's struggling to move forward. But the flip side of it is that there's still reason to remember this particular past because the past isn't finished yet. The kinds of wars that we're fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan as Americans are repetitions of what's happened before. And what I try to do in the book really is try to situate the Vietnam War in a much longer history, starting from 1898. I think that what we've been doing in the United States has been going on for over a century. In 1898, we took the Philippines, Guam, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, started going to the Pacific, Korea, Vietnam War, and now Iraq and Afghanistan, is this a further extension of the same thing, the extension of American domination?
You make reference to Dr. King, who I have said many times, I regard Dr. King as the greatest American this country's ever produced. You make reference to Dr. King's words from beyond Vietnam. Tell me, as a refugee, how his words, even all these years later, resonate with you and your family.
Well, I think most Americans prefer I Have a Dream, or they remember I Have a Dream. And as a refugee, that's what you're supposed to think of too. But when I read Dr. King's speech in Beyond Vietnam, I thought, this is a speech that all Americans need to read, even though it's long and complicated and hard to listen to, because he's basically connecting the things that happened in the United States in terms of racism and class warfare and the exploitation of poor people of color and poor white people to a racist war in Vietnam. So for me as a Vietnamese refugee, what that speech does is that it takes us out of our sense of our own victimization, to going back to this Jewish example and other examples. Everybody likes to think of their suffering as unique, but in reality, sufferings are connected. And if we want to overcome these histories of exploitation and warfare and so on, we can't think of our own suffering. We have to be able to connect it to other people. And that's what I think Dr. King was trying to do in that speech. And it's such a difficult reality for people to hear.
Yeah. I recognize that you don't really close on the death of loved ones the way you close on a house or some other business deal. But has the U.S. closed this chapter in the way that we ought? And if not, what remains to be done?
I don't think America has closed this chapter. That's why with Iraq and Afghanistan, the Vietnam War example kept coming up. And I think it's going to keep on coming up. And the reason why we will never close the door on this history is because how the United States got involved in Vietnam as an extension of its military-industrial complex and this project of global expansion, we're still doing it. So we can't close the door on something that we're still doing, which is why Vietnam keeps returning as a war for Americans.
You tell the story. You mentioned earlier how your parents didn't want their names in the text. But you also tell the story of how while you've gone back to visit Vietnam, as you mentioned, where you were born and left as fled as a refugee. But when you go back, you have yet to go back to the place of your birth, because your father has basically told you are forbidden to go back to that place. Tell me more about your father's laying down the law on that and what that's all about.
I also mentioned the Jewish example in that particular example.
Exactly,
you know, Art Spiegelman, the graphic artist, you know, he talks about the Holocaust, and he talks about how his father told him when Art Spiegelman was going to go back to Poland, don't go there because they still kill Jews there. And my dad, we're from this small town in the center of the country, he said, don't go back there because these people will remember that you're my son and they're going to persecute you for it, which I don't think is true. You know, but the point is that I've disobeyed my father in many things, including going back to Vietnam, but I can't go back to where I was born simply because, I don't know, maybe he's right. That thought sticks in the back of my mind, and part of it is terrifying to me too, as much as it's terrifying to him. So the past isn't over. Nothing ever dies. It matters even to me.
Do you think you might visit that place when your father's dead? And I ask that because we just referenced, both you and I referenced Dr. King a moment ago. His sister, who's still living in her 90s now, Christine King Ferris, the last remaining member of that immediate King family, has not gone back to Memphis all these years later. Got close a couple of times, I'm told by her, but has never returned to Memphis where her brother was assassinated, even after his death. So I wonder whether or not you think you might be
be
pulled into...
Yeah, that thought's in my mind. You know, I have to confront the fact of my parents passing on, and then a new kind of history opens for me. But I'll tell you something else that I didn't talk about. I talked about it briefly in the book. We have an adopted sister, and when we fled the country, we left her behind, and she still lives in that town. So for me to go back to that town means I also have to deal with that history of how the war divided my family too, and how the path of my brother and myself took one direction, and the path of my adopted sister took a radically different direction. So that's hard for me to deal with.
We just will see this in the text, but just to just give a little bit of how you and your family, in fact, your mother and father, did eventually get reconnected in this country.
What happened was, you know, we came to the United States as refugees, separated to live with different sponsor families, and we came back together after a few months, which to my four-year-old self felt like a really, really long time. And that was, you know, that was the reunification of the family, and moved to San Jose, California, built a life there, and that's our version of the American dream.
Yeah, and now you're a professor at USC.
Good or bad.
The book that you recall that came out a while ago, The Sympathizer, a novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen, went on to become a national bestseller, one of the 100 notable books by the New York Times in the year 2015. That was fiction, and now he's out with nonfiction. It's called Nothing Ever Dies, Vietnam and the Memory of War by Viet Thanh Nguyen. Viet, congratulations, man. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Harry Lennox is a familiar face on TV and in the movies. He's a featured player on NBC's hit drama, The Blacklist, and he reprises his role as General Swanwick in Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice. He's also a tireless advocate for diversity in Hollywood and always a welcome guest on this program. No, you are diversity in Hollywood. Good to see you, man.
Great to see you, Travis.
You been all right?
I've been, well, busy.
Yeah, been busy, yeah.
Was at the premiere for Batman versus Superman. We had a great time.
Yeah.
Everybody showed up.
Yeah. Did you like it?
I did. I have to tell you, I was...
You hadn't seen anything, yeah.
I did a little bit of ADR, a little voiceover work
right,
on it.
Right.
But I had only seen it in snippets. But I have to tell you, I'm convinced that it's going to blow the charts off.
Yeah. Blockbuster here.
I think so.
Yeah, of course.
You don't want to jinx these kinds of things.
Yeah.
But I would say if quality matters in these kinds of tentpole projects, that this is a good sign.
Speaking of tentpole projects, how do you make your choices? Because you're a uniquely different kind of brother, and we'll talk about that and the way you see the world and the choices that you make. But how does Harry Lennix go about making the choices that he makes? Because one day you're in a blockbuster like Batman vs. Superman or the movie Ray or... you know, Five Heartbeats, right? You're in these blockbuster kind of projects, then you'll do these independent things, including your own independent work. So how do you go about making choices about what makes sense for you to do or not do?
A lot of it comes down to availability
and
opportunity and people who are interested in the kind of work that I do.
Yeah.
But I would say that you never really know if something's going to be a blockbuster. You might have a pretty good idea, like if it's The Matrix 2 or 3, which I was lucky enough to do.
I could have said that and I didn't, but go ahead.
Oh, that's all right. That's quite all right. You know, you have a pretty good idea that people are going to be interested in it. And we have a pretty good idea that people are going to be interested in Batman and Superman.
Yeah.
But normally it comes down to if there's a script that is out there, it's really on the page.
Right.
And it's really the quality of the work that I think is the final determination for me.
Yeah.
If it's something that I think is interesting, even if I'm not all up in it, it'll be something that I'll be willing to participate in.
Yeah.
And if it's something that is off the beaten track, that'll show a different side to a story that is otherwise not going to be seen, then it's something that I'm likely to take a second look at.
Yeah. As you look back on The Matrix, you were in, as you mentioned, 2 and 3, and our friend Cornel West was in one of those things.
Yes.
I remember the scene, yeah. When you look back on those two movies, why do you think they so resonated? That was such a huge trilogy.
Well, I think the science behind it, really, it's more than the science behind The Matrix. It's the philosophy of
it.
Cornell actually wound up doing a kind of companion piece to The Matrix movies called The Philosophy of The Matrix, I think it was called, or it might have been called Through the Wormhole. I can't remember exactly what it was called, but it was really a bunch of top-notch philosophers talking about what the ideas behind The Matrix were.
Mm-hmm.
So when we think about things like what is intelligence, what is artificial intelligence, how will that manifest itself in the future?
Yeah.
We really don't know. We're at a time now when maybe in 20 or 30 years as the expanse of intelligence and as the rate at which these things are accelerating, we'll be able to really do a la carte human experience.
Mm-hmm.
We got these glasses now or whatever. I think Samsung's coming out with these virtual reality glasses. But if you think about the idea that sort of prompted The Matrix, it was a Charles Baudrillard philosophical treatise called Simulation and Simulacra.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that at some point, somebody will be able to create a map which will fit exactly over a landscape and will be so real that you won't be able to tell the difference between the virtual reality and the reality.
Yeah.
So now you've got hyper-real versus real, where people are really expressing a preference for the simulated thing, for the virtual reality over the reality. And I think that that's increasingly happening in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got now gender assignment things happening. You're going to probably be able to pick eye color. You may eventually be able to pick race. So I think that as humans advance, we will be outstripped by the advance in technology. And so we're going to have to really figure out what it is that we want to experience as a human experience. So I think that's going to be endlessly fascinating. I think if you release The Matrix today, it would be as influential as it was however many years ago that came out.
Let me get all up in your Kool-Aid, all up in your business just for a second here. Because based on what you've just said, I know you to be a man of faith as well. Based on what you've just said, how does that challenge your faith, your Christology?
Mm.
How do you juxtapose those two things, what we will be able to do and what God
the creator has intended?
It's a very excellent question, and something that that I've sort of nibbled around. Mm-hmm. I haven't really put it in that way, which is why you're you. Yeah. Which I enjoy talking to you so much. But I think that, you know, when it comes to the idea behind God, mm-hmm. theology in itself.
You went to seminary at one point years ago.
I did.
As I recall. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I did.
I asked the right question here of the right person.
Yeah. And I really enjoy reading the works of philosophers and theologians, particularly Paul Tillich and, mm-hmm. and people of this nature who describe in their mind, or even somebody like Aquinas, who I regard mm-hmm. as the greatest of all of the sort of Christian philosophers.
Sure.
I think that God, in some sense, has evolved along with us, or our conception of him or it has evolved with us. I think that God is so big that we can't possibly conceive all of what it is and all of the perspectives on that. So I think that really it is we who have evolved. Mm-hmm. But when you get down to sacred writing, and when you get down to scriptural writing and understanding of what his message is for us and in our present, I think that it has to evolve. So I think last time we talked, I may have mentioned that, you know, when the prophet Muhammad came along, mm-hmm. He said, or he described God in such a way that was for that specific group of people at that specific time. When the Honorable Elijah Muhammad came along, who gave to black people at that time in 1930, when the Nation of Islam was sort of getting its feet under it, mm-hmm. What is God? Who is God? How do we describe him? Is he a man? Is he like us? Even if you look at the Bible, you know, God wrestles with people from time to time. Mm-hmm. He walks with people from time to time. He can appear in many different ways. But it is. But I think that the real question for me is, how is God personally revealing? And I think that really ultimately is where it gets down to. Mm-hmm. God for me has to be somebody who is like me, or I am somebody who is like God. Mm-hmm. And I have to be able to find myself in him at all times, and to be able to find him in me. Mm-hmm. And I think once we get to the place, and I think a lot of us, and when I say us, I'm talking right now about black people in America, that we go so far outside of ourselves to find God, somebody that does not look like us, mm-hmm. somebody that does not have our best interests at heart, that we're trying to appease something that we can never appease, mm-hmm. because it is antithetical to our nature. So for me, it has to be something that is harmonious with what is in our life, in the world, in nature. And I think if we can get into harmony with that, mm-hmm. always trying to ascend to a higher vibration, if you mm-hmm. will, then I think that we'll be in union with that God.
You mentioned the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, which made my mind immediately go to your hometown of Chicago. And I think the last time I actually saw you in person, we were in Chicago. We ran at each other and ended up having breaking some bread together.
That's right. That's what we did.
Had dinner together. I was leaving town, and you were just arriving town to start filming Chirac, the Spike Lee film. So it was great. So it's the last time I saw you in person, I think. So it's been great conversation and controversy around the film. The film was done, it came out, and people had their own reactions to it. What's your post-mortem now on that project?
I think that Spike made one of his best movies in many, many years. Mm-hmm. I think that is something that we've all, that we were all proud of. Mm-hmm. My good friend John Cusack, who's also from Chicago. I didn't get a chance to work with Sam and some of the other people, but I did with mm-hmm. With Angela Bassett and a bunch of other people. We were proud of what we were doing when we were doing it, trying to stem the tide of violence there. And this is, again, goes, I think it speaks directly to what I'm talking about. When you can look at somebody in your neighborhood, a neighbor, a friend, a brother, and see something or somebody that is not worthy of life, and that you can just rather whimsically dismiss of, just with a gunshot, not thinking about what the impact of that is, then that's a horrible circumstance. And that means that we are people who are not in union with our God. And so I think that Spike, even though he faced a lot of controversy because of the title of the movie, mm-hmm. that's really what the crux of the matter was.
Yeah, and Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of the city, kind of led that fight.
Rahm Emanuel led the fight, and we now see where the city is with regard to the mayor. He's one of the most unpopular mayors, I think, in America right now. Maybe Snyder, who's the governor of Michigan, might be competing with him. But, you know, a rose by another name, as it says in Shakespeare, would smell as sweet.
Yeah.
And garbage would smell as bad. And I'm not saying that about any person. But I'm saying about the circumstances in Chicago. There are fewer resources in Chicago in the poor neighborhoods that desperately need them than there are in the richer, most well-endowed neighborhoods. Schools are closing. These kinds of things are happening in Chicago. They're happening all over the world. My sister was affected by it. She was a principal. It's closed the school down for no particularly good reason. So you're now having, people are now having to go outside of their neighborhoods, outside of their communities, further deteriorating the quality of life they're in. And they're finding themselves really with not a lot of advocacy. And I think that that's a crime.
Yeah.
And I think, and honestly, you know, I see a lot of this Black Lives Matter and all of these things with people saying important and valuable things. But I see a lot of that being projected now on people who are running for office. But I do not see the same kind of accountability for the people who are currently in office. And I mean that should go all the way up to the White House. It should go to the Attorney General of the United States. Why are we not telling them what is important in the Black community? They're the ones who can right now, not talking about 8 months from now or 10 months from now or 5 years from now or 20 years ago, right now, those are the people who need to be hearing these lessons. And I think that Rahm Emanuel, who had an issue with the title of Chirac, really should start dealing with what is the subject matter of it, which is that when you take away resources, when you take away opportunities from neighborhoods, which is Chicago calls itself a city of neighborhoods, you're going to get these results. I don't think there's anything surprising about it at all.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. More now, my conversation with actor Harry Lennox.
There are two things I want to ask you about specifically, since you've called them both by name. And I'm on record clearly with my feelings about this, but this is your conversation, so I want to, I'm curious. Given that cover-up, that's the only word I can think of, that just untenable, unacceptable, unbelievable cover-up in the Chicago Police Department that Mayor Emanuel was aware of, should he be dismissed from office? Why is he still in office?
I think there's a couple of, you know, those kinds of questions have real answers to them. And I think one of the reasons that he's still in office is because people voted for him. And they voted for him because he was endorsed by certain people and he made certain promises to certain people, some of whom are my friends and who that I have great regard for. And he made these promises with the belief that in some way the situation was going to get better. But the situation has not gotten better. And since that election in March of last year, that's when the Laquan McDonald thing happened. It already occurred. But the fact it became, the facts
tape
became
revealed
thereafter. And of course, so to me, that's a gross misrepresentation of the truth. It's a lie. It is a cover up. And I believe that that is worthy of the strictest penalty. And if I were he, I would resign. And I think that there are people who are capable, who can fulfill the role of the mayor. So, look, I don't vote in Chicago anymore, so I have very little to say about it. But my family still lives there. My friends still live there. And I have to tell you, I think that there, if all up and down the political spectrum in Chicago, heads should roll. And it's not a race-based thing. It's people who knew what was going on, who deliberately covered it up.
Since you raised his name, in the middle of this controversy about this cover-up in the Chicago Police Department, Barack Obama, President Obama, goes back to Chicago, as he does from time to time, and on one of those trips made it abundantly clear how he felt about Rahm Emanuel. He said, I still stand by him. No surprise, he campaigned for him twice when he ran for mayor. Then he comes to town in the midst of all this drama and still says, I support Rahm Emanuel. As you well know, being from there, a whole lot of black folk went crazy in Chicago when Barack Obama made that statement, still standing behind his guy, Rahm Emanuel. But since you raised his name earlier in this conversation, we're near the end now. We're nearing the end. You knew Barack Obama when he, before anybody else knew him, in Chicago. You guys were friends and hung out. And there are a lot of people who watch his mannerisms at times and the way he presents himself and know that he learned, or it, I won't say learned, I don't want to disrespect the president, but that things rub off on you when you hang with people who are actors and et cetera, et cetera. So your style, your approach, people have made that comparison. I'm not the first one to say that. But I guess the question is, given your friendship that started so many years ago in Chicago, as we near the end of his two terms, what's your assessment of how your friend has done?
Well, I think that's, in all honesty, I thought that there would be a lot more controversy, a lot more pushback against the president from the Congress and so forth. And I know a lot of people lay the blame at the feet of Congress. Mm-hmm. But I like to remind people that he had a supermajority in both houses of Congress when he got into office. And he took that power and he took that mandate, if you will, and squandered it on something which I think is a feeble health care bill when we have far more urgent issues to deal with. I think that there were promises made that were not kept, stuff dealing with civil liberties. The Patriot Act was doubled down on. Mm-hmm. The bank bailouts happened. We're hearing Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton talk about mm-hmm. these things now. Prison sentencing reform, nothing has moved on that. So all of the disparities and the people making complaints now about the three strikes you're out thing that President Clinton, at the time he was in office, signed into law, there are things that could have fixed that, ameliorated that. And I think that I can almost look at every other demographic or special interest and find something that was gained in the last 7 years or so. But I can find nothing that was gained on behalf of the black people. And so I'm just as a constituent and as a person whose primary interest is in the amelioration of the condition of our people, I'm disappointed. But I understand it's a difficult task and that he has to be the president for everybody. And so taking that into account, I guess my grade would be a C minus. But I would have to say it could have been a lot better. And I think that there was an opportunity here that was missed. I think that a lot of white people voted for the president mm-hmm. And wanted to see something done and nothing was done. And I would rather that had been done because I don't think there's going to be anybody coming anytime soon into that office that's going to be able to address these issues that really has the kind of power of the body politic behind it. Now, when I listened to Secretary Clinton and to Senator Sanders speak, I hear things that I like. And so I'm hoping that in the very near future mm-hmm. that we'll be able to really get some progress.
There are some who've suggested that if Hillary Clinton is the presumptive Democratic nominee, there's some who suggested that if she is elected, that she would actually can, in fact, will, some believe, get more done for our people because she won't be boxed in by race in the way that either he was or chose to be.
I would agree with that. Yeah. I would certainly hope that that's the case. I was a surrogate for the secretary mm-hmm. in 2008. I would be happy to serve in that function again. But I think more than waiting for anyone, politician, mm-hmm, sure. To do anything on our behalf, specifically in these matters, I think that we really have to start taking the ball into our own hands, the matters into our own hands.
I also have not seen you since we had the Oscars So White controversy this year, but I was anxious to talk to you and to get to you. I said, I wonder what my friend Harry Lennox, of all the people's opinion, I had a number of folk asking my opinions, and I wrote an op-ed about it and did some stuff for CBS about it, but I really wanted to know what Harry Lennox thought about it. So here's my chance now with 5 minutes to go to get your take on the year that was or wasn't at the Academy Awards and this issue writ large. We've seen the Academy President Sheryl Boone Isaacs come out and make an announcement that there are some new people now who are on the Board of Governors. They came out and made an announcement. They're trying to change things. But what's your sense of this morass of...
Right, we're the state of the art, as it were. I think a lot of those moves are good. Yeah. I applaud them. I think that anytime we could talk about inclusion and sharing power, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. I do not, however, believe that the window dressing in and of itself is going to change much. My issue with the Oscars being so white is when black people are nominated for things and when they win certain awards, whether it's the Academy Awards or the NAACP Awards, it's very troublesome what they win for. Mm-hmm. And I think that the subjects that we are ourselves putting our resources in, making movies about, making television content about, are troubling. We continuously go back to the past mm-hmm. to deal with these issues. When we have issues today that are not being addressed. And that's one of the reasons that I applaud Spike and Chirac for Chirac mm-hmm. and for doing that, and a couple of other people. Creed, I think, you know, mm-hmm. movies that are being made about an empowered group of people who are fully realized modern circumstances that they're dealing with.
In real time, yeah.
In real time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. I think that the Oscars, it didn't surprise me. I don't watch the Oscars anyway, so I mean, I can't boycott something that, that I didn't pay much attention to in the first week because I don't think that awards are the point.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that the point is that this is today. Movies, television, internet, communications of a whole. If you look at the number of tickets sold in America in 2014 or 2015, some billion tickets or so, almost half of those are going to be bought by black people. And what they are consuming is not nutritious for them. And so what I would rather see, rather than worry about the awards mm-hmm. that people are getting and for what they're getting them for, they should really start looking at the content. And I've said for a little while now that we get to see ourselves downtrodden more than we are represented in the population. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's really the point. So it seems to me like a lot of that stuff is for insiders, an elite group of people who get together and congratulate themselves every year. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. They have a right to do that and to make the movies that they want to make and so forth. But I would rather we switch the conversation to something far more relevant.
So as an actor who has the capacity, the power, the ability, and the platform for your own independent company to do something about that, what do you do?
Well, I think one of the things that we really have to look at is what we are consuming. And I think the other thing is how we get that out, mm-hmm. where we put those things and who puts them out there. So distribution is hugely important. Very little black distribution. I don't know what it is for Latinos and for Asians and so forth. Of course, they have Bollywood and all these other mm-hmm. kinds of things. But I don't know really what's going on with regard to distribution for black people. We still have to go to other groups of people to see if they like what it is that we're doing. Mm-hmm. So I think that the real issue is to try to fix the machinery behind the content and then also to fix the content at the same time. For me, I think that I want to be a company that creates classics. Mm-hmm. I want to be a manufacturer of classic fare and content. And I think that that's not an easy reach. We have great literature. Some of the greatest literature in American history is written by black authors. Mm-hmm. Some of the greatest scholarship is being done by black writers and black scholars. Some of the greatest music, some of the greatest dance, all of these things should be celebrated throughout the world. And I intend to use my platform, if such a thing should exist and come into being, for that purpose.
Harry, good to have you on the program, man.
Great to be back.
You can see Harry Lennox anywhere. Batman versus Superman, The Blacklist, everywhere. He's doing a little bit of everything, and I'm always glad to have you back on our program. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.